Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thank you to Cedar for inviting me here today. I recently spoke to your members in Brisbane, so I'm very touched that you've invited me back. Very kind of you. So, what is our water policy? Our water policy is to ensure that Australia's water future is secure and sustainable. It is to ensure that we use a scarce resource as efficiently and productively as we can. It is to ensure that wherever we can, and we know we cannot do it everywhere, but wherever we can, we drought-proof our cities and communities. We have to recognise that water is not everywhere a finite resource. It is often spoken of as being a finite resource, but as I'll explain in a little while, in many of our cities, our water restrictions, which are held out to be designed to protect and preserve a scarce finite resource, have really got more to do with protecting the cash flows and the dividends of the government-owned water utilities. The water policy for Australia is set out in the National Water Initiative, which was agreed in 2004 and to which all states and territories are parties. We often are dissatisfied with the progress of water reform, and it's good that we should be. We should never be satisfied. We should never be complacent. But our water planning and our water management in Australia is often held up as the gold standard to which other countries should aspire to. We have made more progress in water planning and water management than any other comparable country, and so we should be proud of that. But we also have to recognise that not only do we live, as we all know, on the driest continent, but more importantly, our rainfall is highly variable, very variable indeed. That is why the storages that we have built, both around our cities and in the country, are enormous by world standards. Sydney's storages for the Sydney water supply contain more than 4 years of water for Sydney when full. That's assuming there was not one drop of water entered those dams, which of course, even in a drought, considerable inflows. So we have massive storages because of that variability. We are truly the land of droughts and flooding rains, as we see all the time. Most of our water falls in the north, far away from population and indeed from most of our agriculture. The heartland of our agricultural wealth and productivity, the Murray-Darling Basin, home to 75% of all our irrigated country, receives only 6% of our runoff. Now, the National Water Initiative, which was the agreement between most Australian governments, now all Australian governments, in 2004, following on a COAG agreement in 1994, is designed, as I said, to ensure we have a secure and sustainable water future. It was a collaborative effort led by the Commonwealth, in particular the Prime Minister and John Anderson, but I'm very pleased that both Jennifer Westacott and her former boss, Craig Knowles, are here today because in their respective capacities as head and Minister of Natural Resources, they were both intimately involved with the establishment of the National Water Initiative. And just on that point of the involvement of states working with the Commonwealth, while I know there have been calls from some of my colleagues for there to be a constitutional referendum to take over, vest in the Commonwealth all power over water, everyone would understand that with my background and experience, I'm more cautious than most about the prospects for constitutional change. But let me say that even if that were a great idea, and I have very little doubt that if by some, trick of history, we were sitting around drafting a new Australian constitution today from scratch, I have no doubt that the jurisdiction over cross-border waters, interstate waters, be they surface or groundwater resources, would be vested in the Commonwealth. I'd be very confident that that would happen. Maybe that confidence misplaced. The fact is that wasn't decided over 100 years ago. And so water reform has to be a collaborative effort. And it has been, and there have been great achievements. And while progress has been slower in some areas than in others, and there is still a great deal to be done, we will achieve these reforms working together. We cannot put it all in the too hard basket in the hope that some years from now, many years from now, if ever, there would be a constitutional change. Now, water is a vital necessity of our life. Our cities, our farmers, our nation, industry, miners, everybody. None of us can live without it. The towering arches of the Roman aqueducts that still march across the valleys of Europe remind us that great civilizations are built on the wise management of water. If ancient Rome's 11 aqueducts 2,000 years ago could deliver 1 billion litres of water to it every day to its million inhabitants, this at a time before powerful pumps, before pressurised pipes, before recycling systems, before reverse osmosis membranes, before any of that technology, how can we seriously continue to lurch from water crisis to water crisis in our great cities? Some societies have been luckier than others, with regular rainfall, bountiful rivers, and a sense that water is an abundant free good. But that has never been so in Australia. Our rainfall is the most variable in the world. Our rivers are the most variable in the world. Unlike cities in the Northern Hemisphere, we have to have huge storages, as I described. And all of our cities, with the exception of Adelaide, which of course has the Murray River, have enormous storages relative to their annual demand and, of course, relative to comparable cities overseas. Irrigation would be impossible without the regulation of our rivers. Commencing in the 19th century with weirs to allow local water supplies and navigation, we now have dammed almost all of our river valleys, certainly in New South Wales and Victoria. We cannot manage without it. Irrigated agriculture occupies a tiny percentage of our overall agricultural land, but represents more than half of the profit from the agricultural sector. So it's our challenge and our mission to manage our water for future prosperity. But first, let me set out a couple of parameters which I think are important to bear in mind when we think about water. Firstly, water is very heavy, often overlooked. Notwithstanding it's often described as the new gold and a precious resource, it is precious, it is sadly not very valuable. A ton of gold is worth, on my calculations, well over $20 million. Someone else might be able to do the calculation more currently. A tonne of water can be delivered to your bathtub any time of the day or night here in Sydney for around a dollar. Put another way, water has a low value to weight ratio. That means unless you have gravity doing the work, the cost of moving it around is also very high relative to its weight. Another important difference between water and gold is that water is not a finite resource in the way minerals are, or indeed the way people assert that oil is. We can have as much water as we are prepared to pay for. So water is only finite up to a point. The reason water is a finite resource in inland Australia is that the cost of getting more water there is so high nobody could ever profitably make use of it. But there is absolutely no excuse for our cities, especially those on the coast, not being drought-proof. We can make as much and more water than we need from recycling. There is enormous scope for recycling in all of our cities, and a national recycling agenda is a vital policy objective for us. Or if we choose to take the most expensive approach, if you like, the Rolls-Royce approach in terms of expense, not necessarily in quality, we can go to desalination. So why are we being told that water restrictions in our cities should be permanent? The water business has very high fixed costs and capital investment requirements. The operating or variable costs are modest. The marginal cost of a water utility selling an extra 100 gigalitres is very low. The dams are there, the pipes are there, all the way to our homes. So what happens in a drought? Let us imagine that we are concerned that demand exceeds supply by 100 gigalitres. We know that the price elasticity of demand for water in cities is very low indeed. Some estimates suggest it's around 0.1. little more than that, others would say. So putting the price up will not constrain demand, but we cannot run out of water. If we impose restrictions and as a consequence demand drops by 100 gigalitres, we sell that much less water. And because the marginal cost was very low, that foregone revenue was mostly profit. So why didn't we increase supply by building a new recycling plant or a new dam or a desalination plant? Why didn't we spend the money to augment supply? Well, the reason is because the marginal cost of new water, as IPART recently observed in the case of Sydney, is in fact a little more than the retail cost. I think between $1.20 and $1.50 is what they've estimated. And we know that Perth, for example, is desalinating seawater for $1.16 a kilolitre. So there's a real live test in an Australian city. So what that means is that if we were to augment our water supply to fill the 100 gigalitre gap between supply and demand, we would make little or no money out of it unless we put up prices, and materially. So why is this picture then different from electricity? Indeed, why do we believe it's appropriate to ration water when we know we can make water, but we do not regard it as appropriate, other than in crisis, to ration electricity when we obviously can make electricity? Rationing electricity, indeed, is unacceptable, other than in, as I say, in crises and, you know, perhaps in the hottest day in the hottest summer. The difference is, of course, that the supply of water is dependent on climate, both rainfall and runoff. So if we were to build our new plant to produce that 100 gigalitres to fill that gap, and we did fill it, and then it rained and the dams filled up again, we would have 100 gigalitres of supply a year more than we could sell, and we would have increased our cost base with a supply of water, the marginal cost of which was especially high. So if you believe that the dams are going to fill up again, if you believe the rain is going to come back, it always makes sense for a water company to constrain demand rather than augment supply, if the cost of augmentation is at the levels that it is in all of our Australian cities today. The days of cheap water are over. Another difference, of course, is that we pay a lot more for electricity. The ABS estimates that in 2003-2004, Australian households paid on average $311 for water and $1,200 a year for electricity, gas and other substitutes. Fresh water and energy are both vital, you know, vital necessities of life, and yet there's an enormous gap between what we pay for them. So what is the conclusion? Are water restrictions designed to conserve a scarce, finite resource? Well, yes, in the short term they may be. But in the long term, their principal contribution is to preserve the profitability and cash flows, strong cash flows of water utilities, and enable the postponement of investment, which would increase the cost base of that utility and either decrease profits or force an increase in prices. The short point about this little excursion on the economics of urban water is that there is no reason why our cities should be short of water, no any more than they should be short of electricity. We do not have a water shortage in Sydney or in Brisbane. We have a shortage of management and preparation. You know, we attribute the shortage of water to the drought, but that is only one factor. We can have as much water as we wish. And we have to ask ourselves whether we should be demanding of our politicians, principally state politicians and in some places local government politicians, demanding of them that they supply our cities with the water they need just as readily as they provide our cities with the electricity they need. You've no doubt seen the recent CSIRO report on the water needs of our cities. More People, Less Water is the title. Mike Young I'm sure many of you know, was the principal author, I believe. It makes the observation that as our cities are growing in size and therefore demand for water is increasing, so our climate in most of Australia, except the tropical north, is warming and drying. We'll have more people and less water. The paper calculates that unless we're prepared to augment our water supplies with manufactured water, or buying water from the countryside, which of course is only available in a significant way really in Victoria, they assume that prices will skyrocket, and I think they postulate in one scenario people will be paying $10 a kilolitre in Brisbane, which, even though I think Brisbane's water's too cheap, I think that's going a little bit over the top. Now, that is, in some respects, a penetrating glimpse of the obvious. Of course, if nothing is done to augment supply, there will come a point where restrictions are no longer effective to constrain demand, and in theory, at least, prices will rise exponentially. But the dire predictions are unreal. I repeat, we can make as much water as we want in any of our big cities from recycling, or if we choose to do it, from desalination. We have that capacity, and we should demand of our state governments that they provide the water we need. We should demand that our cities are drought-proofed. They can be. Having a city which is perpetually short of water makes no more sense than having a city which is perpetually short of power. Now, of course, this cost of manufacturing water, be it from wastewater or from seawater, is one of the reasons why so many of the great pipeline schemes that I think all of us secretly love, I think all of us probably, I'm not sure, maybe it's those Roman aqueducts I referred to earlier. We all love the idea of great pipelines crossing the nation. But the problem is that they are so uneconomic. The Kimberley to Perth pipeline canals proposals were recently studied by a very eminent group led by Reg Appleyard and including Don Blackmore, and the GHD were the major consultant. I see there's quite a team from GHD here today. And the water would be delivered at a cost which was more than five times the cost of desalination. So there you have desalination, which Bob Carr once called astutely bottled electricity. That looks cheap compared to piping water from one side of Australia to the other. Now, in terms of the overall water agenda, it is a massive one. It is, as I say, to ensure that we have the water we need where we need it, but at a price that we can use it efficiently and productively. Our cities, obviously, particularly our big coastal cities, as I said, can afford to have all the water they need and more. Rural Australia faces much greater challenges. The irrigation sector, not to speak of dryland farmers, face enormous challenges, particularly in the wake of climate change. That is why the National Water Initiative, as one of its key elements, focuses on first adjusting allocations to sustainable levels. Making those allocations, and that is painful. And many of you will either have suffered that pain or know people who are going through that painful adjustment process. Having made that adjustment, the resulting entitlements, which are a share of the pool of water that can be consumed, then becomes a real asset that can be traded. Why is it important that water should trade? Well, some people would say it's a pious genuflection to the memory of Adam Smith. Well, it's not. It's not. I do believe in the invisible hand, but the real reason is that the only way, the best way, we can ensure that a resource which is scarce and will become scarcer in rural Australia is allocated efficiently is through the market. And that is the importance of water trading. So we have a number of important initiatives I saw there's someone walking behind me there. In terms of our national water policy, pursuing the National Water Initiative and its execution is a vital one. I'm meeting with the state and territory water ministers next week to discuss that, and in particular the process, which is a gritty process, I concede, of converting these existing water rights into sustainable and secure entitlements. The completion of water plans and so forth. All of this is very detailed, painstaking work, but it must be done because it is that basis, that sustainable basis, sustainability and security, which will enable water to be allocated most efficiently. At the same time, we have to recognise that just as we waste water in the cities, and of course we are all familiar with the measures we can undertake in the cities to use water more efficiently, so there is enormous waste of water in rural Australia through inefficient irrigation practices principally. And through the program, the Living Murray Initiative in particular, we are focused on funding infrastructure which will make the use of water more efficient. We do the same thing through the Australian Government Water Fund, a $2 billion commitment that Jennifer referred to earlier, which is also in large measure focused on using water more efficiently. We will be launching very shortly a tender to buy water for the Living Murray Initiative target of 500 gigalitres by 2009 through a process called the Water Through Efficiencies Tender, which is an initiative I announced in Adelaide a month or so ago, where we will be buying water on the basis that it is water that has become available by reason of savings. So if you have, by replacing an open channel with a pipe, by using a more efficient method of irrigation, a centre pivot or subsoil dripper tape or whatever, if you have saved water, that water that you've saved, we would be prepared to buy through the tender. That agenda continues. It has been supported, remarkably, uniquely, I suspect to everyone's surprise, by the $500 million commitment to the Murray-Darling Basin Commission in the last budget. John Howard not only believes water is our greatest environmental challenge, but he has put the Commonwealth's money behind his efforts, all of our efforts, to ensure that we meet it. I am very confident that our approach to water management in Australia is on the right track. I believe the National Water Initiative is the right policy. There are challenges in implementing it, but I am satisfied that as long as we continue to work together, we shouldn't run ourselves down, but as long as we're tough on ourselves and recognise in a way we're fighting against the clock, because just as we're trying to save water now, just as we're trying to augment water supplies now, to use water more efficiently now, we have to recognise that we are likely to have less water to use in the coming decades than we do today. It's a great challenge. It's an important one. I'm sure that together we will meet it, and I look forward to your questions and insight. I've spent many hours with a lot of you on water matters. Only recently, Peter Sutherland from GHD brought the Chinese water minister along to see me to talk about their canal, which puts everything into perspective. This is a canal to bring water from the south to the north of the country. And I said to him, how wide is the canal? And he said, where? And I said, well, how wide is it at the outset? He said, 2 kilometres. So put everything into perspective. Thank you very much.